Well, I've been preparing most of you today for this talk. I've been hinting about it. The full talk is now posted on the blog, if you want to take a look at it afterwards. You know, for months I've been talking about a new way other than Advaita and Robert's self-inquiry, and his kind of tepid emotionality. Well, something happened over the last few days, a discovery. I'll talk about it a little in a few minutes, but let me try to remember in the same way that I listed it on the blog. On Facebook, there's a million gurus. Neo-Advaitin gurus are aplenty, along others. And there's one guy, Tony Cleary, O'Cleary, who is a self-proclaimed critic of all the gurus on Facebook, the bane of Facebook gurus. If you're a guru on Facebook, he's told you you're full of shit at some place or another. And he's got a lot of likes after that comment that he would make. For Tony, there's only been two gurus alive. He calls them muktis, completely empty ones, completely liberated ones. And that's Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta. He said, all you Facebook gurus, including Admusica, are phonies, fakes. You're not muktis. Not like Ramana Maharshi and not like Nisargadatta Maharaj. They are muktis. Their teachings are always available. You don't have to listen to anybody else. Don't go to any other teacher. These two dead teachers are it. Their books are available everywhere. And Tony has appointed himself as their spokesman. Tony speaks for Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta, according to Tony. I bet you I'll get some comments from Tony about this when this is posted on Facebook. But you know, he's got a point. When I was at Mount Baldy Zen Center and I first started sitting in the ultra-rigid style of this Japanese concentration camp, sitting cross-legged, with people beating you with sticks if you'd move an inch, one develops samadhi very quickly. The temperature could be below 6 below 0 outside, and you're wearing a thin jacket underneath your hakama. You're sitting and you can see your breath out 3 feet. They don't turn the heat on in the morning, except for the first 10 minutes, and the last 10 minutes in the evening. It's ultra rigid. And when you sit with attention and alertness, because it's the only way to get warm. And what happened to me over and over again is my mind froze. My head felt like a rock. That's why I keep saying, become stupid like a rock. No thoughts could penetrate. And it felt as if I were going to sleep. And then all of a sudden, my mind dropped completely away, and I awoke and I saw the world around me in an entirely different way. It was ultra vivid, and there was no longer a separation between me and it. Me and it, the manifestation, were one. With my eyes closed, I could hear the airplanes go overhead, and I would be flying through the sky like the plane. Or I could hear the wind in the tree, and I'd become the wind in the tree, blowing over Mount Baldy. Any sound, I'd become the bird. I was one with the manifestation. There was no longer an Admusica. There was no longer any thinking. Just wondrous new world, a world of newness, of brilliance, of intensity. And I was it. Now at Mount Baldy on a normal day, we'd sit two or three times, except during retreats, and then it could be four or five times, depending on the intensity of the retreat. At Rohatsu Sesshin, the one in December around Christmas time, we'd sit five times a day. And they'd be groups of two or three sittings of 25 minutes each. And we'd have a koan, like, how do you realize God when looking at a fir tree? And within 5 minutes of sitting, my mind would become a rock and disappear, and I'd wake up into this new world. It's called Nirvikalpa Samadhi, or Kevala Nirvikalpa Samadhi. It happened to me time after time after time. I would rush through koans that Roshi would give. I would go through two or three or four koans a day. Just breeze through them. Solutions would come to me instantaneously. After 3 months, people are still working on their first koan, and I had been through dozens, maybe 100. But when I came back to me. All these wondrous experiences of wonderment, of oneness, unicity, non-dualism. And yet I felt like the same schmuck that I was when I entered Mount Baldy 3 months before. At the parties after the Sesshin, I still got too drunk. I still drank too much. I didn't feel as if I had changed one bit. I didn't know what the hell those experiences meant. Did they give me a new reality? Is this the way the reality is supposed to be? Or when I returned, was that the reality that was supposed to be? Which was more real? The transcendental oneness experiences or the schmuck experiences, which were predominant? I left Mount Baldy, heavily disappointed. For a number of reasons. Mainly it was a Japanese concentration camp. And I didn't know Japanese. But for years afterwards, when I went to the International Buddhist Meditation Center and lived there, became a monk there, these experiences would continue. Every morning I'd get up at 4 o'clock and start meditating, facing a wall with a candle. And I'd disappear time after time after time after time. Nirvikalpa Samadhi, temporary unicity, temporary oneness experiences of such brilliant intensity. Colors were vivid, everything was vivid, but I didn't change. After a while, they just sort of died away. The experiences stopped coming. I got involved with too many different Zen teachers, and I got to confuse the hell out of me. Each one gave me different koans. Each one had a different approach. I lost that original, intent that I had, the direction of I had, which is to pursue who am I, self-inquiry, and got distracted into koans and different Zen systems, etc., etc., etc. 5 different Zen teachers at once. No. Never do that. Too many books, too much intelligence, too much thinking, too many books, too many teachers. It all dissipated, all the power dissipated. And I left and got involved with Muktananda and all the sweetness and love of Muktananda, loving the self. And I couldn't figure out what the self was, so I didn't know how to love it, so I left Muktananda too. And then I ran into Robert. I had given up totally, and I ran into Robert. I had given up. I hadn't seen any teachers in a couple of years, and then I went to see Robert. I don't know what brought me there. Somebody said, hey, go see Robert. And I did. He was my teacher. I knew it right away. I didn't trust him, though, at first. It took me 3 years before I really trusted him and surrendered to him. Recognized I had tried everything I could think of for over 25 years, and I still hadn't achieved. I had had hundreds and thousands of these samadhi experiences. I had read all the books. I knew all the Zen philosophy, all Advaita philosophy, and had not attained. In other words, I was like Tim. No progress, no change. After 25 years, I was still a schmuck. And I gave up. I ran into Robert. And after 3 years, I surrendered to him because I could feel his emptiness. Robert was completely empty. And hanging around him emptied me. I could feel his emptiness. And I was so full of shit in comparison. Robert knew I was full of shit too, and he kept working on me, cooking me, lying about me behind my back, or telling the truth about me behind my back, whichever suited his occasion. Whatever it is to get people upset at me, and me upset at other people at the satsang. Robert delighted in this. I could see the big smile on his face when we were stabbing each other in the back. He could see our emotionalities coming up, the idiosyncrasies, the jealousies, the anger, and he reveled in it. I could see that smirk on his face whenever he really got somebody. He was cooking us. A lot of people ask whether I'm cooking them. Actually, I don't dare cook some of you people. You're too explosive. Don't mess with dynamite. But a lot of you cook yourselves. I don't have to do anything. But was this? Anyway, I was with Robert for several years, and he left 1995. I still hadn't awakened. I gave up. Just listened to chanting music. Laid on the couch and became a couch potato. I wasn't working at the time. I couldn't work anymore. I became totally dysfunctional. Just listened to sacred music. Laid around, introspecting. In other words, I became like Joan. Totally useless. Everybody's complaining about her functionality, my functionality. And I had this big experience of stepping in a shower, trying to look at who was getting wet and feeling the shower. I was feeling great that day, feeling wonderful. I looked inside and there was no one there. There was no one that the word I pointed to or that the name Edward Musica pointed to. There was no inner entity that I could locate, no objective entity that was Ed Musica. All that I found was emptiness. If somebody called my name, the answer came deep from inside, within the subjectivity, but there was no object anywhere that was me. And when the object me disappeared, so did the Tao, that which was opposite of the I. The I in my head was inside, and the Tao was outside. This was the conceptual map I had. I, me. Me, 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 me. You in the world. And what separated us was my skin. Outside the manifest world, inside my subjective world. And in that subjective world, there was no Ed Musica. What a discovery. At first, I was scared shitless. I was wondering, there's nobody home to protect me. But there's no me to be protected. But I felt so frightened, I almost fell to the floor in the tub because I was so scared. There's no protection. I was naked, more ways than one. I had no protection. Suddenly, there was no longer any boundary between inside and outside. The inner emptiness became the outer emptiness. There was only oneness once again, just like the Nirvikalpa Samadhis I had at Pombaldi. Only this time it was based on the knowledge that I was not. I did not exist as an entity. But not existing as an entity has certain benefits. If you don't exist, you can't die. You're already non-existent. You're already just an illusion. So what are you? I began seeing thoughts floating through the air like floaters that some people who are nearsighted have, like little clouds. You get close to the cloud and suddenly you become the thought, and the thought manifests like a chair or a wall. These thoughts were not my thoughts. They were everyone's thoughts. They were the universal thoughts that are floating through space. And I was like a radio receiver receiving certain kinds of thoughts that were peculiar to Ed Musica. While other people received other thoughts, like Joanne perceived her thoughts, which made her who she is. And Joan, and Tim, and Tina, Janet, John, and everybody else out there. It's sort of like we become a peculiar idiosyncratic radio for certain kinds of thoughts and perceptions. Along with our genetics, it determines who we are. Some of us get thoughts about psychoanalysis. Some of us get thoughts about technical stuff like how to make cranes or cars. Others get musical thoughts and they compose music. Others are artists. I had a whole shitload of thoughts and they all disappeared. They all disappeared. And I reveled in this experience for a long period of time of oneness, the same kind of unicity, the nirvikalpa samadhi, but this time combined with the knowledge that I did not exist, which was not there when I had nirvikalpa samadhi. Nirvikalpa samadhi, I didn't exist, but I didn't have the knowledge that I didn't exist. This was jnana, knowledge. Knowledge I was not as an individual entity. This was an awakening experience. And a few weeks later, I had another awakening experience where I saw that the states of consciousness came to me. The waking state came to me. The sleep, the dream state, they came to me. But I was unaffected. I was not of this world. I was beyond this world. Another awakening experience. But you know, 6 months later, I was very depressed. Still a schmuck. I hadn't been transformed. In a way, I had been. But in a bigger way, I hadn't been yet. What did these experiences show me? They showed me emptiness. They showed me various kinds of emptiness, emptiness of me. The nirvikalpa samadhis showed me no me. My awakening experiences showed me no me. But what of it? I still was not transformed. And this is what a lot of the questions were today. I still didn't feel substantively transformed. I did, in many ways. I felt peacefulness. I felt happiness, which grew and grew. But there was still the nagging that there wasn't the kind of transformation I needed. A few days ago, Janet Beyer sent me an email. It was a quote from Ramana Maharshi. She was very excited. She said, "Edgy, look at this, look at this." And I did, and I got excited too with her interpretation. Listen to the quote. This is Ramana Maharshi. Questioner asks Ramana, "What are Kavala Nirvikalpa Samadhi and Sahaja Nirvikalpa Samadhi, Ramana said, "The immersion of the mind in the self, but without its destruction, is Kavala Nirvikalpa Samadhi. In this state, one is not free from vasanas or vasanas, and so one does not therefore attain mukti or freedom, liberation. Only after the vasanas have been destroyed can one attain liberation." Questioner, how can one practice Sahaja Samadhi? That's the final samadhi. Ramana, even from the beginning, that is, you can perhaps practice Sahaja, because Sahaja is you, really. It's not something you reach or attain, it's finding out who you are. But even though one practices Kavala Nirvikalpa Samadhi for years together, if one has not rooted out the vasanas, one will not obtain liberation. This is exactly what happened to me at Mount Baldy. For years, I had practiced and experienced Kavala Nirvikalpa Samadhi. We all called it Nirvikalpa Samadhi, these oneness experiences. If one has not rooted out the vasanas, one will not obtain or attain liberation. Now, definition of vasanas is basically a Buddhist concept, and he borrowed it. Vasanas are karmic residues, unconscious propensities, disposition, habit energy, thoughts, habit formation, habitual patterns, impressions, imprints, inclinations, inherent tendencies, karmic impressions, predispositions, mental imprints, negative psychic imprints, potentiality, predisposition, propensity. And we should include in that all the qualities and tendencies of the unconscious mind, including developmental failures, childhood psychic injuries, etc. In other words, we're still a schmuck until we work through all the egoic stuff. All the injuries, all the hurts, all the jealousies, all the anger. This shit keeps coming up no matter how developed you are. It just keeps coming up, coming up, coming up, coming up. Thank you, Janet, for that. That's really a breakthrough. Because what Ramana is talking about is that working through these vasanas or vasanas has to be done before one obtains liberation. However, you can obtain awakening experiences before one is liberated. And the awakening sort of reveals the path to you that you have to follow. The emptiness and voidness experiences that you experience on awakening, like I did, those Nirvikalpa Samadhis at Mount Baldy, or the awakenings with Robert, show you a kind of emptiness. Show you your true identity. Of emptiness, of nothingness. And inside of you arises the intuition, this is how I have to be as a person, emptied of all of this shit, all of the inner mess, all the brokenness, all the tendencies, the predispositions, the developmental failures, the neediness, the desires, the being full of oneself. All of this has to go. This is what's revealed on awakening. The path is lighted for you. It shows you the voids that you have to go through and become. To become, finally, the void of voids, as Bernadette Roberts called it. The void of God, the nothingness of God, where you take his perspective rather than your own anymore. It's no longer a human perspective. Actually, this discovery is stunning in the breadth of the revelation that it reveals. It means you don't have to do Advaita first, and then do a path back, like Sansa Neem talks about, of reaching emptiness as reaching the first or second base, and then coming back into the marketplace. Or you don't have to be like Advaita, obtaining enlightenment, the oneness and unicity experiences, and even going beyond that to become prior to consciousness and recognizing your true self as prior to the world. It doesn't have to be done sequentially. Because the routing out of vasanas can happen either before awakening or after awakening. But it has to be done before one obtains full liberation. So Joanne keeps saying she wants to disappear now. And you're working through your vasanas now. The awakening can happen now, can happen in the future, and I'm sure there'll still be vasanas to work on after that. But the path will be lighted. Your way will be lighted. You'll know instinctively from then on how to empty yourself. Now the Bhaktis, in the Sufi tradition, is a subset of the Bhaktis. The whole effort is to work on these vasanas. Not to meet these problems, these jealousies, these angers, these resistances, these tendencies to run away. With indifference, by just witnessing them. But to embrace them as they arise. When shit happens, instead of becoming indifferent to it inside of yourself and trying to look at it objectively, instead you should embrace it and not run from it. Embrace the problems. Embrace the hate. Embrace the jealousy. Embrace the anger. And I'm sure you have to act it out somewhat. But embrace the feelings. Welcome the feelings. Don't run from them because they're too much. Embrace it insofar as you can. Insofar as you can tolerate it. And you'll find that your toleration grows and grows. And the emotions get bigger and bigger that you have to handle. It's like weightlifting. Every week and every month, you could become a little better at handling feelings, watching the feelings, accepting the feelings. So all of those questions that were addressed to me today about, I've had these experiences, and I still don't feel any fundamental change. You got to realize the difference between awakening and liberation. Awakening is the first true insight you have as to your own nature. And it reveals the path of progressive emptiness of yourself in your personal life. That the path you have to take as a human being, dealing with human issues, whether it's children or a job, spouses, Facebook gurus, whatever. There's one more key. One more key. Also mentioned by Janet. The way is through love. The original Yani, even the original Yani awakening is done because of love. Love for knowledge. The knowledge of one's own being. What I am, what am I? The intense desire to know who I am, and to love who I am. Even the Yani is driven by love, love of knowledge, desire for knowledge. And let's say you have that original awakening. You see the road of emptiness lying ahead of you that you have to travel as a person, as a Tina, or a Tim, or Joanne, or as an Ed. How do you walk that road? It's because you see the stuff arising. And you know that that part of you that's arising is not consistent with the emptiness that you experienced in those experiences. But because it doesn't fit, do you reject it? Do you run from it? Oh, you embrace it because you're empty. And in your emptiness, you can eat the problems that arise and dissipate it in your emptiness. You let those feelings and those problems envelop you, completely take you over. Express them if you want. And then they pass away and dissipate. Gradually grow. You learn how to become more empty. It's actually a process of surrender. Surrender to your inner self and to the outer guru or to a lover or to a child, to something other than you. So awakening is the first step. Well, it's not actually the first step. Doing the various kinds of spiritual practice like meditation or self-inquiry or dwelling on the I am. That can be both working on the vasanas or vasanas and also inducing the original awakening process or experience. And one can use some of those same techniques progressing from the awakening to full liberation. But I think if you're looking for a single method, it doesn't work. It depends on who you are and what you're comfortable with. Some people will want to do Reikian therapy. Others will want to do psychoanalysis. Others insight therapy. Others release therapy of some sort. Others will just want to work in relationships with a lover. Others will work with a guru. And in an ashram setting. You know, there's no one way. But that one way is lighted by the insight you have of seeing emptiness in is your true nature, and that you're not empty as a human being. And then you're drawn along by love for that being inside of you. You want to become as empty as your experiences of emptiness. And gradually you transcend your humanity and become of service to others rather than of yourself. Because the same sentience in you is in everybody else, and you see it in their eyes. You look into the other's eyes and you see yourself. You see that same consciousness, that one God staring out through 100 billion eyes. And you worship that one consciousness in the other and in yourself. And that worshiping, that surrender, is part of the process. But the one overriding, or the two overriding principles are, those experiences of awakening reveal the path to you that you have to take. And love carries you along with it. Whatever technique you use. Without both together, you're doomed. You'll never awaken. And actually, they're one thing, two different manifestations of one thing. So Tony, in his worship of his two dead gurus and being spokesperson for therefore, is wrong. You really need a live guru to do all these projections on, to guide you. It's not necessary that this person be the perfect Ramana Maharshi or Nisargadatta. In psychotherapy, we say that there's no perfect parents. And if you had to be have perfect parents before you became a well-adjusted human being, how many well-adjusted human beings would there be in life? What you need are good enough parents that don't fail too often, that don't abuse you, that don't constantly criticize you, that don't have all kinds of psychological hang-ups themselves, and are adequate parents that give you enough holding, enough caretaking, enough loving, enough support, enough freedom, enough boundary setting, that you develop as a normal human being without too much misery in your life. Good enough parents. Same thing with psychotherapists. You need a good enough psychotherapist. You don't need a Freud. You don't need a Jung. You need a good enough one, or possibly better than good enough. Same thing with a guru or a teacher. Same thing with a lover or a spouse. They don't have to be perfect. Just good enough. And then God supplies everything. Tony, keep Ramana, keep Nisargadatta. I'll take what is given to me.